On a near-term basis, the sheriff should continue to perform well.
Controversy about Google's possible plan to re-enter China. It's Monday, August 6th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, concern about election rigging in Pakistan. Australia parched under severe drought. The Vietnam War in photos. The brain's natural barrier. And 3D knitting. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Two people with knowledge of the plans told media outlets that Google hopes to launch a revised version of its search engine in China that will block some websites and search terms in a bid to return to the world's largest internet audience following its departure 8 years ago over censorship concerns. But they caution Google's return is not imminent. According to the news website The Intercept, the project has been underway since 2017 and has been demonstrated to Chinese authorities. Terms such as human rights, democracy, religion, and peaceful protests are reportedly being blacklisted in the search engine app. Tech giant Apple, meanwhile, has regained growth in China. The company, with a market value of around $1 trillion, posted third-quarter revenues in excess of $53 billion, with a fourth-quarter forecast of between $60 billion and $62 billion. Although its smartphone sales fell, it made some money on its most expensive phones and other services, such as its App Store and music subscriptions. Tom Forte is an analyst with the New York-based equity research company D.A. Davidson. Speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty, he said a key to Apple's recent success is a friendlier tax climate in the United States.
The company's focus on the luxury portion of the categories it chooses to participate in consumer electronics enables it to generate a lot of free cash flow. And when you consider the favorable tax regulation changes that's enabled it to return more of this free cash flow to shareholders, in the June quarter alone, they bought back $20 billion worth of stock. And that was $10 billion on their prior authorization and $10 billion on their new $100 billion authorization.
Now, it's lost market share in smartphones, and the industry itself has begun to slip a little bit. Where is it becoming more profitable now?
Sure. Actually, so what I would say is that if Apple were to say, what was the lesson that the company learned on the iPhone 10? The lesson is, when you sell a device for more than $1,000, you can sell fewer units but still bear the financial benefits. And if you look at that, I believe what happened. And I think that that's a lesson that they're going to apply in the future. So I don't think they're going to back down as far as the high prices for their devices.
Most of its sales now overseas. Apple is regaining growth in China. But what about U.S.-China trade tensions? How might that impact the company?
That's a great question. And I would say that is probably, on a near-term basis, the most significant risk to Apple. And I would argue that they could face a double whammy. To the extent that their prices could become more expensive for all consumers from tariffs, that would be the first challenge. And then second, they generate a fair amount of revenue to selling products to Chinese consumers. And an escalated trade war between the U.S. and China could, I think, also put that sales at risk. Now, working in its favor is that the company has pricing power. So versus other companies that are being impacted or could be impacted by these tariffs, Apple has the advantage of having pricing power. So on its products, if they were 10% more expensive, it may not be as damaging to demand as you would think.
What is Apple's future? Is it overseas?
On a near-term basis, the share should continue to perform well on a combination of the continued success of the smartphone and the ample buyback program. Further out, the company is going to need to, in our opinion, refine its go-to-market strategy when it comes to the connected home. And the argument can be made, we would make the argument, that they're well behind Amazon and Google at this point. And then in the future, the smartphone and tablet may not be the center of the connected universe, and Apple is going to have to make some adjustments to make sure it's not left behind.
Apple is the world's largest company by market share and has been for 7 years. But as Bloomberg News reports, history suggests such a status can be short-lived, given the performance in recent decades by corporate giants like General Electric, ExxonMobil, Microsoft, and PetroChina. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find currently trending on VOAnews.com. Detained Chinese professor moved to unknown location. Deadly earthquake rocks Indonesia, Lombok Island. Pompeo wraps up Southeast Asia tour. North Korea stole their children. Thailand's cave boys complete time at Buddhist temple. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has wrapped up his Southeast Asia tour. He met with Indonesian President Joko Widodo Sunday, telling him the U.S. values its ties with Indonesia. Saturday, the top U.S. diplomat met with his Indonesian counterpart as they discussed bilateral cooperation and multilateral engagement on regional security challenges, including North Korea and counterterrorism, as well as other foreign policy issues of mutual interest. Pompeo arrived in Jakarta Saturday from Singapore, where there were mixed messages on relations between the U.S. and North Korea amid talks over denuclearization. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert told reporters Pompeo and North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Hong-ho approached each other during the family photo session and shook hands. Pompeo said, quote, "We should talk again soon," to which the North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho responded he agreed. After that, U.S. Ambassador to the Philippines Sung Kim delivered to Ri a letter from President Donald Trump to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The contents of the letter were not disclosed. Just after Pompeo left the annual ASEAN summit, North Korean Foreign Minister Ri delivered a statement saying his country is committed to adhering to the agreements made between Trump and Kim at the Singapore summit last month. But he called the U.S. attitude on urging other countries to keep up the sanctions on North Korea alarming. Ri's remarks followed the release of a United Nations report warning that North Korea has found ways to navigate around the sanctions. Pompeo said the United States is taking any infringement of the sanctions very seriously. There are also some serious questions being raised in Pakistan over the fairness and transparency of the polling process more than a week after Pakistan went to the polls and the party of internationally renowned cricketer-turned-politician Imran Khan claimed victory. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from the Pakistani capital, Islamabad.
Leaders of several of Pakistan's largest political parties gathered in capital Islamabad Thursday to denounce last week's polls as rigged.
"We reject the results of these elections as well as this election commission. We will continue protesting these results both inside and outside the parliament."
The party said they would field their own candidates for prime minister against Imran Khan of PTI, who won at the polls. The parties allege the Election Commission of Pakistan was working with the powerful military to help Khan's PTI win in polls. Around 370,000 military personnel were assigned to provide protection during the polling process. Several candidates complained that military officials overstepped their mandate and illegally interfered in the vote counting process. Some started tweeting about it as soon as it happened.
"In several places, our polling agents were thrown out, and in many places, the military officers bypassed the civilian presiding officers and became the law enforcing authorities. They did not follow the laws of the Election Commission."
The Election Commission says the polls were free and fair, and adds it used its powers to try and provide a level playing field to all parties.
"We have not received any serious complaints of rigging. Candidates who suspect rigging should follow the legally prescribed paths to a resolution."
Khan said he would support efforts to recount the ballots in constituencies where rigging was suspected. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
Happening now in Asia, at least 37 people have been killed by a powerful earthquake that rocked the Indonesian island of Lombok and nearby Bali, triggering a brief tsunami warning and sending residents and tourists fleeing into the streets. Sunday's quake was recorded at magnitude 7.0 by the U.S. Geological Survey. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're starting out a brand new week on VOA Asia. We're glad you're here with us. Farmers in eastern Australia say they are in the grip of the worst drought in memory. Some landholders have not seen decent rain for 7 years, and the government is promising more help to hard-pressed communities. In New South Wales state, about 99% of farmers are dealing with drought conditions and are not producing enough food to feed their animals. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia is a land well used to nature's extremes. It's the world's driest inhabited continent, but the resilience and ingenuity of its farming communities are being severely tested. Southeastern Australia is in the grip of a drought worse than many can remember. Last month was the second hottest July on record and the driest since 2002. Most of the nation's most populous state, New South Wales, is in drought. In some parched areas, storms of dust have forced children to wear protective masks on farms. In the small town of Manila, 460 kilometres north of Sydney, high school students Steve and Olivia say the conditions can be tough.
We wear dust masks in the round yard and everything, in the cattle yards, because it just turns it into powder.
Yeah, it's just powdery.
Mm.
It's like you can't breathe.
It'll get all in your lungs and everything, yeah. And we've noticed our horses starting to get a little bit crook, like they're breathing difficult because of the dust.
And 11-year-old schoolgirl Isabel says her farming family is struggling to cope as livestock prices fall and the cost of grain to feed animals goes up.
We've pretty much been running out of money every fortnight and there's no water, there's not really much feed.
The principal of the Manila Central School is Michael Windred. He says the drought is having a significant psychological effect.
There's a fair bit of hardship going on. It's not until you really look back and think, OK, there has been a real increase in students seeing the counsellor. There has been a bit more increase of, you know, it's that feeling of a bit of a despair, if you like.
Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has promised to do more to help those under intense financial pressure due to the drought. He's approved emergency special payments for eligible farmers, as well as extra funding for mental health services. The so-called Big Dry isn't affecting all regions of the country. In July, parts of Western Australia, the Northern Territory, Queensland, and most of the island state of Tasmania received above-average rainfall. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, visually tracing the roots of the Vietnam War. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia, 84-year-old Chun Wen Guang, a retired professor from the Shandong province of northeastern China, who was apparently detained by Chinese authorities during a live telephone interview with VOA last week, has been moved from a military-run hotel where he was held to an undisclosed location. The latest developments can be tracked on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, war photographer John Olson recently joined VOA Asia Live on Facebook to talk about his experience photographing the Vietnam War and telling the stories of the Marines through his pictures. As a young 20-year-old photojournalist for Stars and Stripes newspaper, Olson documented one of the most brutal battles of the war, the Battle of Hue. His exhibit, The Marines and Tet, is currently on display at the museum in Washington, D.C. Here's an excerpt from his interview with VOA's Skylar Ogden.
The Tet Offensive was a battle that occurred on began on January 30, 1968, during the beginning of the Vietnamese Lunar New Year. It was a surprise attack. that occurred all throughout South Vietnam, and it's the battle that many historians say became the turning point in the U.S. involvement in Vietnam.
And why was it a turning point?
Well, prior to the Tet Offensive, the American public had been led to believe that all was good, that the Americans and the South Vietnamese were winning the war and American troops would be home soon. And the Tet Offensive was a surprise. The media attention it caught and the perception it received in the U.S. was such where there was a turn against the war.
Within the Tet Offensive, there was a major battle, the Battle of Hue, and your exhibit here covers the Battle of Hue. Can you tell us what happened when that battle began?
Well, if you're a combat photographer, you can't fake it. You really need to be in the midst of things, and the more violent, the better. So the Battle of Hue was extremely violent. It was house-to-house fighting. These Marines had never experienced house-to-house fighting. The Citadel is a part of Hue City in which it's like something from the Middle Ages. It's surrounded by 30-foot walls and a moat, and the Marines went in there to clear it from the North Vietnamese. And it was house-to-house, horrific fighting.
And so were you scared when you were there?
You know, people ask me that, and during my time in Vietnam, I didn't know fear. But I don't want to confuse that with bravery. I wasn't brave, but I didn't know fear.
And you found many of these veterans later.
Right.
Decades after you took the photographs in this exhibit. Tell me about that project.
Well, when I went into Hue, the Marines had been there a day or two. They were 18, 19, 20 years old. They were dirty, they were hungry, they were cold, and they were angry. And it was a type of fighting that they weren't familiar with. These were jungle Marines. They'd never had house-to-house experience. And like many veterans, I came back and spent 45 years not talking about Vietnam. But as the 50th anniversary of the battle approached, I began to wonder what had happened to these 18-year-olds that I'd photographed. I wondered how that battle had affected the rest of their lives. Now, I didn't know any of these men. I didn't have their names, and I had no reference to who they might be. But by chance, I found one of them, and one led me to finding 10 of them. And I set out to record their audio accounts of how that battle had affected the rest of their lives.
Vietnam War photographer John Olson speaking with VOA Asia's Skylar Ogden about his exhibit, The Marines and Tet. Along with the troops who survived, Olson added he, too, was greatly affected by his experiences in Vietnam. You can hear more about that, along with the entire interview, on our Facebook page at VOA Asia. This news from VOA Asia, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has wrapped up his Southeast Asia tour. Before leaving Sunday, he met with Indonesian President Joko Widodo, telling him the U.S. values its ties with Indonesia, one of the world's largest democracies. Saturday, the top U.S. diplomat met with his Indonesian counterpart. Meet with VOA Asia Facebook online for more. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the so-called blood-brain barrier around our brains prevents germs and other damaging substances from leaching in through the bloodstream. But it also blocks drugs for Alzheimer's, brain tumors, and other neurologic diseases from getting to where they're needed. Faith Lapidus has details how researchers are trying to find a way through the barrier.
Work with mice at Imperial College London has shown that high-frequency sound waves delivered through a contact gel in the same way ultrasound is used on pregnant women can open parts of the blood-brain barrier.
So you can think of it as a kind of gateway or border control that is saying the brain needs glucose, that's allowed in. All the foreign pathogens, you're stopped at the door. You're not allowed to come into the brain.
Researchers inject microbubbles into the bloodstream, and targeted sound waves make them vibrate, causing cells in the blood vessel walls to flex to allow drugs to pass through into the brain. Similar research is being conducted at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto. Alzheimer's patient Rick Carr is part of a small trial to see whether specially targeted sound waves could break a temporary hole in the blood-brain barrier. The experiment with Carr and five other Alzheimer's patients shows the barrier opened, let some harmless dye seep in, and then sealed back up.
Just took two ultrasound treatments to show that the blood-brain barrier can be opened. It's very exciting. I feel quite emotional about it because there's a lot riding on this, and it's a whole new world of possibilities, but we have to take one step at a time. We have to make it safe, sure it's safe.
Once MRI scans pinpoint the desired brain location, researchers beam what's called focused ultrasound right at that spot. Further innovations will allow even more precise targeting.
We can create these complex arrays where we can create multiple beam patterns. We can make large beams, small beams. We can steer the beam to any location in the brain. So the technology is so advanced at this point where we can actually deliver the drug to any region of the brain if we can design the transducer in a particular way.
Any likelihood of a therapy is a long way off, but with the burden of dementia growing in many societies around the world, the need for a solution is driving scientists to explore every possible approach. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
3D printers are being used extensively in industry, research, teaching, and hobbies, printing with metal, plastic, and even edible materials such as dough. VOA's George Pudich reports researchers at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh are experimenting with another kind of 3D printing, with yarn.
Industrial-sized knitting machines rarely do custom, one-of-a-kind jobs.
They tend to run these very massive numbers of, 5,000 sweater minimum or whatever.
But these machines can do much better.
With a machine like this, that's not a hardware limitation at all. It's primarily a software limitation.
PhD student Lea Alba, a researcher at the textiles lab at Carnegie Mellon University, says with a more sophisticated programming, knitting machines can produce some very complex items.
This is, of course, just one very long tube that has been bent a bunch of times, and that is specified in that program.
Using elastic stuffing and built-in strings called tendons, it's even possible to knit elements for soft robots.
This is a gripper. It's the first thing any soft robotics project has to make.
Or fancy textured garments.
This is something that I ended up doing a lot of the programming for it by hand.
Alba says that on a personal level, she's interested in how to get people to think of digital machines in creative ways, as opposed to seeing them as something not fun to work with.
We say, you give us a object, same kind of file format as you would use for any other 3D printing process, and we will do our best to knit it.
Alba says much of the 3D printing boom has been the result of wider access to editing software.
Knitting machines are not difficult in the sense that they only do a very small number of things, but coordinating those things to happen at the right time, at the right speed, etc., is hard to think about.
3D knitting of perfectly fitting items could one day see extensive applications, from garments to soft robots to spacesuits. George Pudich, VOA News, Pittsburgh.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. One of the great places you can hear our program is Chiang Mai University, Radio FM 100 at Chiang Mai University in Thailand. Thanks to everyone there today who's tuned into our program and wherever you may be listening to VOA Asia. We'd also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdel-Rahman. Our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. It includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead.